Missing this.
Salah takes the shot. Oh! Oh, Mo Salah with one of the goals of the season. Unbelievable.
And get this. The all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home. Featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis. Plus, almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are. At home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.
Oh, the shame that will get if you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions I have are religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
Well, you're very welcome along to Team 33, and a call here with you until about 10 o'clock this evening. Coming up on tonight's show, we pay tribute to Jack Charlton, who sadly passed away earlier last week. We'll be chatting to Charlie O'Leary, the legendary kit man during Jack's time in charge of Ireland, and we'll be looking at the Boys in Green documentary, which went out on RTE a few months ago, documenting his time in charge of this country. If you want to listen back to this show, you can find us as part of the OTB Podcast Network, available now on the new Off the Ball app in the Google Play Store and Apple Store as well. 53106 is the text number if you want to text the show, or you can tweet us at Team 33. That's all spelled out in letters. Now, we are going to be chatting about Jack Charlton throughout the show, and to help me do that, I'm joined on the line by Colin Buig, by Kieran Bradley, and by Paul Moore as well. Lads, how are you getting on?
All good.
Obviously, it's been an emotional week for Irish football fans. I don't know which of you are the oldest. I don't know if I'm allowed to ask that, but I'll throw this to Colm first. Do you remember watching Jack Charlton's Ireland? Were you old enough to do that? Is that a fair question? Am I completely insulting you in your elder years?
Yeah, well, I just celebrated my 21st last night, so I don't really know much about Jack Charlton. He was like the grandfather of my childhood, definitely. And I got my earliest recollection of any football at all is USA 94 and Ray Houghton's goal against Italy. And then the rest of it for Euro 88 and Italia 90, you're obviously watching back, but it's probably the highlights against England at Euro 88, for the same match, the Italia 90, and for the Romania penalty shootout and Italy quarterfinal, they're probably the highlights that I've watched most out of any football in my whole lifetime. And it went far beyond football, far beyond sport. It was a cultural stablehold in my childhood, and I think everyone else is over the age of 25 in Ireland. Paul, it's very hard to put into words.
Paul, any direct memories of Jack Charlton's era as Ireland boss?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, my first game I went to see that I remember was a USA 94 warm-up, Ireland against Bolivia. It was 1-0, John Sheridan scored. And I was actually, there's footage, obviously, the team coming back from Italia 90. I was on the overpass, that's actually in Santry, when they're coming back from the airport. I went out, it's about 5 minutes from my family home, I went out to greet them. And in the footage in 94, when they're in the Phoenix Park and Pat Kenny is emceeing the homecoming, I was there as well. So I have vague memories of Italia 90 itself, just kind of colours and cheers and celebrations, and my old lad probably jumping around, losing his mind like everyone else in the country. So, but I vividly remember USA 94. In fact, I know exactly where I was for all three games. My folks were even in Giant Stadium, and they were in Florida. So that was the first tournament for me that still vividly I can recall. I remember Germany Bolivia, the opening game with that famous Diana Ross penalty before the tournament even started. So that was my first tournament I remember well. And I was lucky enough to grow up, and my first allegiance to the Boys in Green was Carlton side. First game I was. And I can remember even where I was for the match in Anfield in 95, so I have vivid memories of this.
Am I allowed to ask what age you were?
At Anfield, I would have been 9 years old. I'm 86, so I kind of fall nicely into the category of the glory years. Colm, as a young 21-year-old, he's a blow-in. He's probably a loyal to the Stan regime, not Jack.
Right, so you would have been peak age, really, for growing up watching this Ireland side then. And can you remember the carnage in Dublin around that time? Because everyone who was around at that stage talks about it, but obviously a lot of the people of my generation wouldn't have experienced anything like that.
Not so much Italian 90, because I would have been four, but you see the famous footage of like the walking sound around about, and it's funny just even seeing like landmarks in Dublin that are still there. Like you've got the water fountain on Dame Street, people still congregate on and jump on, and the O'Connell statue, which is always great. But I do remember 94. It was one of those moments when the buntings were everywhere. One of the rare days, you know, when you get like assemblies in school with people coming in. There was every country, every household in Ireland seemed to have the USA 94 milk bottles. Kellogg's had these commemorative cards. I used to collect them. It was just a great time. And oddly, 94 for me, it was the first experience of a World Cup. This is why a World Cup is so good. You see teams that you never heard of. And this is pre-internet and stuff. So, like, the shock of seeing, I remember Saudi Arabia, that unbelievable goal, and thinking, like, the quality of football around the world is incredible. And even aside from Ireland in 94, there was so much drama and stories about it. But it's incredible just the wave of happiness and emotion that can kind of encapture a country in those few weeks. And we'll get into Charlton's legacy, but it's just, in simplistic terms, we've taken away all the tactics and all the football, all the goals and all the controversy. The man just made millions and millions of people happy through his work, and it's something that is extremely rare in Irish society, given the period he started with such a dour time in Irish history.
Yeah, and Ciarán, you're coming at this from a really interesting perspective, because I know you spent a lot of time in England, and was there a feeling around that time, around Jack Charlton, do you remember the sort of attitude the English public had to him, or would have you been too young at that stage?
Well, I'm the same age as Paul there, and funnily enough, in USA 94 was the first proper tournament I remember really, as the first football memory. And for the Italy game, I was over in Ratoth actually, so I remember watching it with the lads, with my family over there, and going crazy for that. So in terms of how he was viewed in England, I think I would have been a touch too young at that point, but I certainly remember the euphoria around USA 94 over here. And in a weird way, particularly when you watch stuff like this, and I'm researching a piece on Jack for the site as well, you get a very weird nostalgia for a place where you've never been really, with stuff like the Italia 90. So yeah, I mean, he was he's such a universally loved figure, and I suppose actually the crux of the piece I'm doing is that he's equally loved on both sides of the Irish Sea, which is actually something that I can't really recall ever happening with another public figure, particularly in sporting terms. So, it was an amazing time. But in terms of offering a little insight into England, I can't really do that at the minute, I think.
Yeah, well, I do want to touch on the point that you just mentioned there, because I wrote a piece for otbsports.com a few months ago during lockdown it was around the time we were doing the Classic Games Club, and I was on speaking about the Celtic 6-1 game against Rangers. And that game was in 2000, so I was only 5 years old. I don't remember watching it live, but I felt an affiliation with that Celtic team. I felt nostalgic watching it. It felt, my emotions were exactly as if I was in the stadium at that point in time, but I was too young to remember it. And I suppose Italia 90, I would have a similar enough feeling towards, because I've seen the reeling in the years footage, the footage of the fans on the streets, and it almost feels as if I was at the event that took place 5 years prior to my birth. So it, like, that's how big a moment Italia 90 was for Irish football, and USA 94 not so much. It just didn't seem to capture the imaginations the same amount as Italia 90, probably because the team didn't do as well. But Jack Charlton brought something really special to this Irish team. Colm, do you remember that sort of change in attitude between Irish football fans, that we actually could go and do something in the 90s? Like, growing up, with this Irish team in the 90s, it must have been such a different thing to what it was, say, for the last 10 years.
Yeah, the previous 10 years. Yeah. I mean, because it ended, it was such a damn squid, like of an end with the Owen Hand reign, and 8,000 people showed up for the Denmark game. And Owen Hand tried to play good football and it just wasn't happening, even though we had good players. And I guess Jack came in and in 1986. And what he did, I'm a bit conflicted because the football wasn't enjoyable to watch, but obviously he's an incredible record. He managed 94 Ireland games and his win ratio was 50%. And they only conceded 63 goals. It was ridiculous. Like, I mean, how well-drilled they were was unbelievable. They were world-class in that, and they were sixth in the world at one stage. That's how well-drilled they were. But what he did, I think, that is slightly underrated is that he was telling well-established, very talented, high-level players to completely change and disregard their game and play safety-first football, which it's not easy to do, to change the minds of players who are very good and have egos. So I would give him great credit for that. The other side of it, though, is that when he came into the job in 1986, we were at such a low ebb football-wise. We had never qualified for a tournament. And nationally, as a country outside of sport, we were at a low ebb too. I mean, Ireland was, in the mid to late 1980s, was dominated by immigration, recession, the IRA, and the church's grip of the country. And it was pretty grim to look back on. So anything at all that was positive was going to be met with raised eyebrows by a downtrodden country. But I guess without even really actually trying to lift the spirit of anyone in Ireland outside of the players, Jack, through the results that we had and qualifying for Euro 88 and Italia 90, brought the country along with him. And the spirits were raised as a result. And I don't think that that will ever be replicated in terms of going from 0 to 90 so quickly. I'm kind of forever grateful for him for that, because I've only known kind of relatively positive times in Ireland. Not because of Jack Charlton, but he played a huge part in that. He's very much in the pro column, let's say.
Yeah, I do want to return to Jack's style of play a little later on, but what I do want to touch on, and it's portrayed throughout this entire two-part documentary series on him, and probably in all of the reports and obituaries and memories that people have been sharing about Jack Charlton over the last week or so, is his personality and how loved he was in this country. Because if you look at the footage, I don't remember in my period of time the manager of Ireland, or any manager, in fact, in football, having such a relationship with the fans, being amongst the people that much, talking to people on a normal level basis, and just being so accessible to the public. I mean, it's. I know it was a bygone era, and it's part of the 90s, and that's just the way things were. But, Paul, I don't think there will be an Irish manager, or even maybe even an Irish celebrity, that will have that affiliation with the public the way that Jack Charlton did.
No, and it really come out in the tribute to him that a lot of the players, even if they may have disagreed with the style of football, they would still run through a brick wall from him. And it kind of comes from his background. I mean, he's from a northern mining town, Ashington. He worked in the mines before he went and signed a contract with Leeds, 17. I mean, he is as salt as the earth as you can possibly get. And even coming in, he was very definitive about his ideology about football. I mean, John Giles for years played with him at Leeds his entire career, and he said, "I wouldn't have a bad word personally to say against Jack. I'd never fall out with him, but I don't see eye to eye with his football philosophy." But if you look throughout it, I mean, it's not all Jack. Let's face it, this was a golden generation of Irish players. I think Charlton would say he was the first one to say he inherited a really good squad. And when you look back at previous campaigns, particularly the one in Euro 82 in Belgium or France, Ireland were victim of a few fairly strange decisions. So, I mean, you do need an element of luck, you know, to succeed, and maybe Owen Hand in an alternate universe would be as revered and loved as Charlton is, but obviously success breeds that bit more love. But, I mean, you look at the footage, it was genuinely akin to what you'd see the Beatles, the way Charlton was ribbon cuttings, kissing babies, getting free pints. You know, you see him at the opening of the Waterford Crystal Factory, he's the one that's there, and usually that's something that's reserved for Taoiseachs and such. But they just loved him because he was really much what you see, what you get. And there's all these, there's some wonderful anecdotes coming out off the ball. We've had them a few. He likes a great soonest saying Charlton, even in his younger career as a manager of Middlesbrough, took him aside and was a huge influence on Souness's career. And then you look at what he went on to achieve, 3 European Cups in the game. I mean, these are his impact on players was seismic. And okay, he mightn't have been as tactically noosed, which I think is a bit of a cut out as well, because a manager basically, his job is to look at what he has and get them playing effectively and winning matches. And as Colm alluded to earlier, his win ratio was fantastic. And every player loved coming to play from him. McAteer on off the ball during the week said that the Irish team used to have conversations saying, we used to regularly talk to each other, wouldn't it be great if we were a club team? They said they used to love getting on the plane to Dublin to come over, even if they weren't involved. And John Aldridge had to run his leg to stumps, like you said in the documentary, and that's why he went so long with it to get an international goal. But he still did it because they bought into the system and they bought into the man.
Another thing that was evident in this documentary series, Ciarán, is the cigar-smoking manager, and that's something we need more of. If you watch any of his interviews afterwards, he's just there puffing away at his cigar, cool as you like.
Yeah, he's lovely. He's a real throwback, and I'm sure it brings us all back to some element of childhood. We've got like a grandparent or family friend puffing away on a pipe or something. He's mad. But he was an incredibly unique figure, and I think going back to what you were saying about his impact in Ireland at that point, like there were a lot of things going in his favour. So, I mean, we all know, for example, now how small a country Ireland actually is, particularly if you want to escape something that's maybe not in your favour. There's a little bit of a kind of rumour mill and that kind of thing. But like here now, we've got nearly 5 million people in the country. There were 3.5 million at that stage. So it was even that bit smaller. And the fact that the media was all that more concentrated was really in the favour of a manager who wanted to get across a message to the people. And because he was doing it in such a way that was so everyman and so kind of gruff and straight talking and stuff like that, and it was great. And he had this real little vulnerability. Like during the course of researching this piece, I was looking at the interview he did with Bill O'Hurley just after the I think it might have been after the World Cup qualifier with Northern Ireland, but he's talking about his little tete-a-tete with Billy Bingham and how, you know, the line was, I said, up yours as well, Billy, because apparently someone, one on the team had said something to Morris Setters. And he found out subsequently that Billy Bingham had nothing to do with it. And basically he interrupted the press conference that Billy Bingham was having, because this was the last match in charge of Northern Ireland. And he didn't mean to do it in front of the press, but he just went in and said, Billy, I want to apologise. Okay, I had been sort of given the wrong information and, you know, best wishes and all this kind of thing. And I just thought that he has this real kind of vulnerability, this real charm to him that very few public figures I can recall have, actually. So, yeah, he's a real miss. And like, it's taken for me a few days for it to kind of properly sink in a bit too much. But like, you know, it's a real sad death. It's one of those ones that you're like, oh God, that is a bit of a gut puncher, right?
Yeah. You know what I find so compelling about his whole tenure is that, like, you have to consider the time, the mid 1980s to the mid 1990s, that an Englishman became the most popular man in Ireland, and that's a testament to the character that Jack was, because I guess Irish people never saw him as quintessentially English, because he wasn't. I mean, there's a video that was up on BBC during the week of a training session that Jack conducts as Middlesbrough manager. And he said that he had a few options when he was considering the Middlesbrough job, and a few abroad that he did consider, but also a few down south that he would never consider, because he doesn't ever want to live in London, ever. And Irish people just took to his sensibility, as Ciarán was saying there. And Englishness and England dominates as a team in that 10-year period, because you have all the English players that he recruited with the granny rule, and then you have the two England games, a Euro 88 and Italia 90, and then you have the Euro 92 qualifier at Wembley, where Jack is booed by the England fans, and he mutters, "I want a World Cup for this country in the stadium." And then you have the Lansdowne Road friendly in 1995, and it dominates. It's a team for throughout the whole tenure. But what is most fascinating for me is that our biggest heroes from that time were English players, or non-Irish players playing for Ireland, Ray Howden, and a manager who was as English as they come, won the World Cup for England, but was the biggest hero in Ireland. And that is amazing. That will never happen again, ever.
Yeah, and I suppose that era throughout Irish history, not only in the football world, is well documented, along with Jack Charlton, as the defining period of Irish history, because you have the New Friday Agreement, the peace in Northern Ireland, you have the country becoming more autonomous from the church, and you also have just this rise of a standard of living, because we escaped one of the worst recessions in history from the 1980s. So it was a defining era for Irish people, and I suppose that's why people remember it so fondly, and maybe Jack goes along with that as well. I do think a little bit too much is made with the correlation between the Irish team and the general good feeling in the country at that stage. I would say that would have been there anyway, but it definitely played a big role in it as well. Another thing that has been attributed to Jack over the last week or so has been his style of play, and I do want to talk about that, because that's something that he was vastly criticised for at the time, despite getting good results. He was also criticised for bringing in English players, like you mentioned, Colm, but it was effective, and if anything, it was almost like a beta mode for what we see nowadays with the pressing from the Man City sides and from the Liverpool sides as well. It just maybe just wasn't that as developed as those. But Paul, this style of play was well ahead of its time, maybe even 10, 15 years ahead of where it should have been.
Yeah, Jack went to the 1986 World Cup, and at the time, the trend was playmakers, your Cruyff, your Platinis, and he took a contrary view to the game. He said, essentially, people in possession of the ball, particularly midfielders, who tend to drop deep and show for the back four to collect the position of the ball, a la your John Giles used to do and Liam Brady for Ireland, multiple players on the ball, are more likely to be dispossessed in dangerous areas and turnovers, and that's where most teams would get their goal from. So his view on international football was very definitive from that period, and he came back and incorporated to Ireland. Now, at the time, we were graced with an abundance of brilliant centre half, Kevin Moran, Mick McCarthy, Paul McGrath. We had some great players in that sense, but his view was fullbacks get the ball, and as soon as they have it, John Aldridge or one of the strikers would run to the corner base, occupy defenders, win possession back, and then that would be, like, in modern parlance, the first trigger. And then after forward run, second trigger, midfield closes, squeezes the space, and in that third of the opposition half, that's when Ireland would retrieve the ball and they'd have territory and therefore, so there was a method to it. And while if you look at maybe more recent Irish teams, in particular the trap era, when I was the Euro 2012 or Watson, that was just aimless long balls into small strikers with no game plan. But this is good delivery. You've had fullbacks like Steve Staunton, Chris Hughton. These were diagonals more than long balls. If you understand, like, they were with purpose, they were with accuracy. And Ireland had an awful lot of success. And Charlton had an assumption that every international defender, whether it be a centre-back or a right-back, wanted time on the ball and figured they could pass the ball out. And if you look at a lot of Ireland's games, they were hard to beat. They didn't concede much. They didn't score much. But they were competitive, maybe, bar the thumping they got in Lansdowne Road in Spain when they were qualifying for USA 94, which Paul McGrath has a bone to pick, because he wanted to play centre-half that day and Charlton played him centre midfield. So they were effective. And even if you look at the results, okay, we rode our luck against England in 88 in that Paddy Bonner had a good game. Gary Lineker will look back and it won't be as fond as memories of playing for England. But, I mean, one of Ireland's greatest performances was in Russia against USSR in 88. Ireland could get the ball down and play when they wanted to. So, to a certain extent, it seemed like the players did have an element of freedom to go and play and express themselves. And in the game against the Dutch, when Wim Keefe scored, Ireland were 8 minutes away from qualifying in their first major tournament in a group which contained the two finalists of that tournament. And then I think the main thing which was a stick to hammer was the Egypt game, which the Irish players even say themselves, Egypt kind of did an Ireland on Ireland, in that they were tough, they were compact, they were tough to beat. And it's in those games, as football fans will know, that's when you want your creative players to go and have some license to play, to express themselves. But the players were so locked into this rigid system that did work for them, that they couldn't pick their brains. But because football moves at such a quick rate, as we see in USA 94, the same tactics that beat Italy and gave us this euphoric moment in our sporting culture were outdated in the sapping heat of Florida against Mexico and the Dutch. And ultimately, by the time you get to 95, that Dutch team in Anfield were three quarters of that superb Ajax team from the 95-96 team under Louis van Gaal, which reached consecutive Champions League finals. Football was just moved past Charlton. But for the period at his peak, he suited tactics to suit his players. And that's what management is.
Yeah, and the best example you can get off the Jack Charlton tactics was his description on Desert Island Discs with Sue Lawley, where he explains it and he almost has a tit for tat with her, because she's saying that it's lump it forward and chase after it, and he's saying that it's much more developed than that. There's reasoning behind it, there's thought behind it, and the way he describes it is that one player has a job, and when another player's job is done, then that triggers the other player to do their job. So it's actually a really modern way of thinking, because if you look at Mauricio Pochettino's book, he explains the way that his Tottenham side played, that if the likes of, say, Alderweireld carried the ball out with his right foot, that would trigger a run from Dele Alli in midfield. If he carried out with his left foot, that would trigger a different run from Son up front. So you're talking about really developed tactics, but at that stage, I suppose, he was so rigid in it. Colm, I know you're a purist. What way do you look at this team? We were obviously quite successful for the time. It can't be underestimated, the sheer breakthrough moment it is for qualifying for your first World Cup ever. So successful in that sense, but style of play, is that something that we look back with regret?
No, not regret. Definitely not, because look at all the good times we had. And it popularised the game in Ireland, because, like, the other thing as well that we haven't talked about yet is that football, or certainly soccer, it was definitely called then, was not the most popular sport in the country, and it probably is now. And he played a big part in that because of the results, because it brought people together. But, yeah, the football was bad, but that was secondary because we were so successful. As I've already mentioned, we were as high as sixth in the world at one stage, which was an incredible achievement. And then by the time we got to Italia 90, because the first 4 years of his time in charge had gone so well, there was expectation going into Italia 90. And when we drew that first game of Italia 90 against England, there wasn't that much of a surprise. And that's why we were so disappointed with the Egypt performance, because they out-Ireland us. But I don't have much of a problem with it looking back, because first of all, I wasn't around, so it doesn't bother me too much. But secondly, he was brave in a way to go that way. It's probably the only way he knew how to play, Jack Charlton. But if you insist on your team playing like that, where it's not aesthetically pleasing, you have to get the results. Because if you don't get the results, no one's going to tolerate it. So it is brave. He could have played pure football and we could have lost honourably, and he would have been applauded, but he got results. But you can't discard what he didn't do in charge as well, where he completely ignored the League of Ireland. He had no respect for it at all. That's why he went and got so many players from the UK. And then, you know, he completely discarded Liam Brady. I think he took him off in his first game in charge against Wales. And David O'Leary, he didn't want to know anything about, and was forced to bring him back into the team. And then, of course, he's gone down in Irish folklore because of the penalty against Romania, which I think was his first penalty ever. So you have to be balanced with it. And the last great performance that Ireland had was the 1-0 win over Italy at USA 94. And although they did start the Euro 96 qualifying campaign very well, it went quickly downhill after the England friendly and the riots. I think Ireland had to get 6 points from their last three games and only got a point, drew away to Liechtenstein, which was an awful result, lost at home to Austria, lost away to Portugal, and then got hammered by the Netherlands. And you look back at the highlights of that game against the Netherlands at Anfield, and as Paul already alluded to, you have this incredibly young and vibrant and fantastic Dutch side. And then you have images of Paul McGrath, Tony Cascarino and John Aldridge looking like they're playing Masters football. Like, they all look like well into their 40s, like well into their 40s. And our team aged dramatically with Jack, dramatically. And there was no improvement made for the latter half of that, of his tenure. So you have to be balanced with it. I have no regrets on how they played because it shaped the happiness of my childhood. That's how strong it was.
Yeah, I think in modern sense, Euro 2016 was as close as we're going to get to the sort of feeling around this Jack Charlton team. Hopefully we might get a few more memories under Stephen Kenny and playing a different brand of football, but it's definitely the same sort of attitude between the style of play and the results, because at that stage, when Ireland beat Germany, it was not pretty whatsoever. We did not deserve to win that game, but we won it. And the carnage in Dublin that night was as close to I'll ever get to what I saw on reeling in the years from Italia 90 and USA 94 in the streets. The streets were full of people. People were hanging out the cars, beeping their horns up until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. It was amazing scenes and an amazing feeling, but the style of football didn't match it. And ultimately, like Jack, that was Martin O'Neill's downfall as well. As Ireland manager, the results started to not match up to the style of play. So eventually it had to come to an end. We're running out of time here, lads, but before we go, Ciarán, I want to get your favourite part of this documentary, because there's two episodes, 50 minutes long, available on RTE Player. There's so much good stuff in it, but what's kind of the stands out for you?
What stands out for me, I really quite enjoyed, and it's maybe like, look, I mean, we've seen all the Italia 90, the nation holds its breath, all that kind of stuff. I think for me, I've seen that a lot of times by this stage. The one that I quite enjoyed actually was just getting a little bit under the skin of the likes of Aldridge and McAteer and Cascarino to a lesser extent about why they chose Ireland and the stories of them actually physically choosing Ireland, like Jack being in the players' lounge with McAteer at Bolton, just being like, you want to play for Ireland, son? So that was great. And also just and really understanding the buy-in that they felt, and as has been mentioned earlier, McAteer saying, you know, he would have loved this to have been his club side. Like, there was a real kind of band of brothers element to it, and they did care. And, like, you know, particularly people like Aldridge and McAteer, and really any Scousers to be honest, would have liked the idea of not only playing for Ireland but sticking one up to England. Like, there's an apartness to Liverpool as a city that they thrive on, and there's such an Irish kind of umbilical link to the city as well. So I really like that, and that was great. It's just punctuated by the fact that obviously Cascarino, I don't know if this is an urban legend, just wasn't Irish, just didn't have. He says in the documentary, he's like, oh, you know, my grandfather was from Westport in Mayo, and he'd be the proudest man in the world. Is that true? Because apparently it isn't. Who knows? But yeah, so that was really enjoyable.
Listen, it was the 90s, it was a lawless time. Paul, favourite part of the documentary?
My favourite part is a part that's gone down in Irish folklore. It's Mick Byrne, the kid, like, on "We'll do them for you today" to the fans. And just that closest bond between the players and the fans, it's palpable in 88 and 90. The Frank Stapleton's doing an interview, I think, in the tunnel in after the pitch in Stuttgart. And he turns to the fan and goes, he's all buying a drink tonight. Like, that, the level of closeness and access, It seems genuine. You can't fake that enthusiasm and that bond. I mean, you look at nowadays, I'm not getting nostalgic, or I'm not like back in my old day, but it's just not. It will never be able to be replicated. In just the way football moves on, and players are rightfully isolated and protected, and it's far more professional. But just the closest of proximity. I mean, there's footage there. You see RT newsreaders. George Hamilton getting champagne shot poured on top of his head in the front of my interview by David O'Leary. The proximity of fans, even in the hotel lobby, walking around, meeting with the players. I mean, it was just a completely different time. But it's sport at what it does best. It lifts you. It makes you happy. It makes you forget about the normality of life. You know, it gives you that lovely escape. And it was just lovely to see at the time that these players took the entire country with them. So, I mean, that's, what else can you ask for?
Yeah, and I think my favourite part was just the old footage of the likes of Bill O'Herlihy, of John Giles in his younger years, of Eamon Dunphy tossing the pen in disgust, and just the different way of life. It just, without feeling, again, overly nostalgic, because obviously there was bad parts of the 90s as well, but this seemed to be the beginning of the increased level of press, of celebrity, but it was just at the nice level where these people were adored by many fans, but they had that connection as well, and it wasn't, there didn't seem to be the same feeling towards that as there is now. It just, we seem to have gone too far with the likes of commercialism, with the likes of celebrity and their status, and it makes me ponder what life could be like if we went back to that. Colm, what favourite part of the documentary?
Just seeing archive footage of what Ireland was like as a country back then was most interesting to me. Like seeing the flights, like the mass emigration, and seeing flights take off from airports and crying families, and it just makes, I don't know why, it just kind of makes you connect more with your country. And then asking my parents, was it really that bad as being portrayed at that time, hearing their opinions about it as recently as this morning, and then seeing the home parade after Italia 90, and just the whole country just stood still for this homecoming, and we had reached the quarterfinals. It was insane. And also like seeing footage of Dublin 30 years ago and very little has changed, and it just makes me smile how similar it all looks.
Doesn't make me smile, Colm. Doesn't make me smile.
Well, it's okay for us, we're not Dubs, so we don't have to be ashamed. But it's just how, yeah, it's just a throwback to what Ireland was like back then, and but at the same time how similar everything is. And yeah, I do agree with you, and I think it was a once in a lifetime period, really, because I just think even with the emergence and dominance of social media, even I think people would have their heads down too much if that happened nowadays. That's not a bad thing. You have to move on. It was of its time, and I loved going back into that time.
Yeah,
but I'm happy as well. I'm happy that we are too.
Without sounding too old man about it, if this was happening now, what you would be seeing in the crowd is not people up on everyone's shoulders and singing and laughing and enjoying themselves. It would be people filming everyone enjoying themselves. It would be a completely different experience, and maybe it would be as enjoyable as it is as it was back then. But I suppose what's in the past is in the past.
The likes of us wouldn't be able to enjoy it because we'd be trying to get that footage and get it online, and we'd be, you know, we have to get this great UGC out there. And I guess that it has become more business. Like, I think we were like a naive, relatively newly established independent country back then, and everything was so new and fresh and everything was good. And we're probably more cynical now because we expect more of it. But we expect higher standards now because of the Jack Charlton era.
I'm going to hold that against you anytime you ask me to film something while I'm out enjoying myself now over the next couple of years when Stephen Kenny's in charge of Ireland. Hopefully we might see a bit more of this. But that is all we have time for on this segment. Anyway, lads, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks.
Pleasure.
We'll take a quick break.
We've had some great days and great nights and good memories. I hope that the people of Ireland have got, I know that they've got the memories. I know they cherish them, and I know that they've enjoyed the days that when they've done something that they've never done before. They go to a World Cup as part of it a couple of times. They've enjoyed that, the European Championship.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me.
The president phoned me and said, "Would you like the job is yours if you'd like it?" And I said, "I would like it." End of story.
I won't forget a single day, believe me.
Well, you know, we're 28-1, I think, we're quoted as, and we're not expected to do anything in this competition. We just hope to surprise a few people.
This kick by Sansomin goes Aldridge, and Houghton! 1-0! Andre Houghton has scored the breakthrough! Jack Charlton cannot believe it!
Nowadays, you see, they've changed it. Everybody in Europe does a little bit of what we did. Everybody in Europe. But they've changed the name, the FIFA guys. They call it pressing. Because they don't want to tell us that we started it. We call it putting people under pressure.
Malta 0, Republic of Ireland 2. And history has been made in Malta. Jack Charlton achieving his victory. Achieving his ambition.
We've qualified for the Go to Italy and we've done it ourselves. I'm absolutely delighted, not only for me, for our lads and for all the fans.
The nation holds its breath. Yes, we're there! And then I saw David coming, and I'm not the greatest believer in centre-backs taking penalties. And then David went back, put the ball down again, and went, sent the goalkeeper on way and put it in, and it went fantastic.
We're there. We're in the last eight for the first time in my history, and it's magic. I'm delighted for the lads. And good luck to the people back home. Great. Hope they have a good time.
Byrne came to me, and he said, our boss, he said, when we get to Rome, this you'll get us in to see the Pope, won't you? Well, that was where the final was going to be played, and I don't think they had a prayer again, but the final. Right.
We prepared properly. We had a little bit of sun. We ate well. And we drank very little. We're going to change that tonight.
You see, it's a bit like religion, isn't it? And football's a bit like religion, isn't it? And Jack's... He'd be like a sort of, I suppose he'd be like a pope or a bishop or something.
He would. But easy, onto it comes Hope, and Hope with a shot, and it's there!
I went into the players and we just sat in the dressing room and we were getting changed and everything, and then somebody come and said to me, would you come out back on the pitch? I said, what for? He said, the crowd won't go home. I just remember, I just cried. It was time for me to leave. I'd been there for 10 years and it was time for me to leave. And I did.
Now, welcome back to Team 33. So that was the Boys in Green documentary. If you want to listen back or watch back any of that, you can find us on otbsports.com. But for now, I am delighted to be joined on the line by the legendary kit man, Charlie O'Leary. Charlie, how are you getting on?
I'm quite well, 96 years of age. Like, when you're 96 years of age, there are three things you're sure of. Number one, you become very, very forgetful. And I can't remember the other two.
Good man. Charlie, the reason you joined me today is because it was a rather sad week for Irish football and for the Irish nation as a whole, because Jack Charlton passed away. And you worked under Jack for a long time. You've been working for Ireland for a long time. When did you start working for Ireland, first of all?
Well, actually, the story was this. I was a referee in the League of Ireland from 1955 to 1973. And during that time, I had the pleasure of refereeing and on the line both for Leeds United. I refereed them and I also was on the line for one game. So then when I packed in refereeing, I got the job of being a liaison officer of when visiting teams came in. When Italy came in as world champions, I went down also to Spain, with Spain down to Flower Lodge. I looked after Poland, I looked after Holland. So when Jack's first game was against Wales, I was looking after the Welsh team. And on that night, I went into the pavilion. I met Mick Bourne for a loan of a pump to blow up the balls. And Mick said, Jack came in. He recognised me, asked me how I was keeping. Had a chat. And when I left, he said to Mick Bourne, what's he doing? I said, he looks after the visiting team. He does this, he does that, he does the other. And Jack said to Mick, who does that for us? Mick said, I do everything. I said, that's a silly. We don't want to invite him along to us. So the next game was against Uruguay. And from then on, I was there from the second match on.
And can you remember your first meeting with Jack as a face-to-face, your first conversation with him?
Well, my first conversation, really, as a referee, naturally, you wouldn't be speaking to him because he behaved himself quite well. But was on that day, the game versus Wales, when he came over and approached me and he recognised me, we had a chat, you know.
This would have been a great time for Irish football under Jack Charlton. You had the Euro 88 and Italia 90, first time Ireland qualified for a World Cup. There seemed to be a great camaraderie amongst the entire group, be that the players, the management staff, Mick Byrne and yourself. Can you remember any of the great stories of that time?
Well, the thing about Jack was this. I never met a man with such charm and on top of that, such man management. For instance, I love to tell you, this is two stories like. First of all, my very first training session, again Uruguay, when Jack took over first, he used to have two training sessions, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. But in later years then, when the lads cottoned on to the system, then it was only one training session. But my very first training session, at the end of the first training session, he called me over and he just said, the lads are complaining about the footballs. Now, I didn't blame them because the FAI at that time, the balls, the old leather balls, the leather was peeling off them. You could see the bladders and all. It was a joke, really. But he had given me. So he just walked away and left me. So I rang the FAI and an official there, and I said, by the way, I told a white lie. I said, Mr. Charlton has cancelled the training session. He said, why? He said, he's no footballs. He said, we sent you out 10. No, I said, you sent out 10 balloons. And he's what he said, oh, don't tell him not to cancel it. And he sent me out 10 new balls. So Jack came along, picked up the brand new ball, just looked at me and smiled, as much as to say, you got the message. Now, he didn't argue or fight on. He just said, the lads are complaining about the ball. That's all he said. And I immediately cottoned on to him. So from then on, we saw it clicked. And the other occasion, another story I'd like to tell is this. For some reason, the lady who looked after the travelling arrangements, when we'd play away matches, we used to leave the away country on an early hour of the morning. And I think it was Belgium. We're coming home. Must have been 5:30 in the morning. And we're in the airport. And I'm standing there. And quite close to me was one of the really, really top officials of the FAI. A very arrogant, ignorant man. I won't, his man is dead now. I'll leave him alone. But anyway, standing beside me. And Jack came along and he said, have you got all the bags on? I said, yeah. And your man said, you haven't got mine. And Jack said, pardon, what you say? I said, he hasn't got mine. And Jack said, he hasn't got mine either. And he turned to me, he said, come here. If I ever catch you carrying his bags or any of that crowd over there, I left you home. So from then on, no FAI official ever came near me to ask me to carry their bags. So on two occasions, first of all, he made it clear that he wanted it done when he wanted it. And the second occasion, he made me feel very important that nobody was going to make a boy out of me, like, you know?
Yeah. And you travelled with a team to Italy in 1990.
Everywhere, yes.
Ireland's first World Cup ever. How special a feeling was that?
Well, that was unreal. Well, actually, meeting the Pope was the other occasion, like, and the Pope was marvellous. And again, the story, if you see the pictures, you see the Pope with his arm around my shoulder. Well, what did happen was that it wouldn't have happened except for Jack. When we went to meet the Pope, I was standing on a step, and Jack was leaning on me. And as the Pope approaches, the President, Lord Reston, Fran Fields, the President of the FA at the time, walked straight in front of me, and so did Dr. O'Driscoll, Lord Reston. They both stood right in front of me, and you couldn't have seen me. And just as the Pope was pregnant on top of us, Jack tapped the two of them on the shoulder. And when they turned around, he pressed them away and pushed me forward. And that's how the Pope then came along and put his arm around me. And all through to Jack, because Jack didn't want to go forward himself. He had to be told that one of the gentlemen came along and took him out and brought him over to the Pope. But he wasn't one of these people that went to the forefront to say, oh, I'm Jack Charlton. He never done that, like, you know.
Would you have spent much time with him outside of the Irish camp?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
And what was he like outside of football?
He was a very, very funny man, really. He could lose his temper. But then, for instance, I tell you again a little story, and it's true. Do you remember when we were preparing, before we went away to America, we were down in Monaghan, a hotel in Monaghan, before we went away to play that match in Belfast,
Yeah.
And we were down in the hotel, and on that Sunday, me were playing in Croke Park. And Jack had gone to Croke Park with Morris Setters. And the minute he came back, I just happened to be outside the hotel. And Jack got out of the car, and he called me over. And he said, do you know the manager of Meath? I said, yeah, I met him a few times. He said, what's he like? And I said, oh, he's about 5'9". I said, look, hang on, I'm not talking about his height. I must be talking to the man, he said. I said, what sort is he, man? I said, supposed to be smashing for getting players together and for teams, like, you know, and get teams fit. So he said, right, he said, now look, when we go in for tea, he says, I want you to sit just a bit away from me, but near enough that I can kick you under the table. And he said, we get Mick Bourne going. So I sat at the table, and we're sitting at the table quite a while, and he kicked me under the table. And he said, oh, by the way, Charlie, do you know the manager of me? I said, yeah. I said, what's he like? So he's about 5'9". I said, don't be silly, I'm not talking about that, he said. I said, what's he like? I said, he's supposed to be famous for getting teams playing together and teamwork and fitness and all that. And he said, would there be an addition here? I said, and we can't say no to anyone. And next minute, Mick Bourne explode. It was, you little so-and-so, you know everything. Now you're an expert on thing. And Jack, the tears started running down Jack's cheeks. You know what I mean? He was in fits of laughing. So Mick didn't know that he'd walked into a like, and it ended up with Mick nearly having a dig at my Jack started it, like, but he really enjoyed things like that, you know.
And it just sounds like you've had good fun along the way as well, Charlie.
Yeah.
If you could tell one story that would sum up Jack and as a whole, is there a particular story from your time there that you can remember?
Well, see, there were that many stories about him. The story that I told, I think, once before, I was on the Late Late Show, and do you know the way the story is about Jack supposed to be what were you saying? Well, he's not too happy to spend, let's say, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the jokes used to be that, do you know the pound coin they have in England? Well, he let one of them fall one day and he bent down to pick her up and it hit him on the back of the head. Jack, as I said, on this occasion, a friend of mine, he had been very, very sick with cancer. Actually, his son told me there was only a matter of weeks when he's dying, or, and he was at home in the house, they took him home. Was it possible to, as a Legion United fanatic, and what's the chance of asking Jack to come? So Jack came to the house. And when he went to the house, he sat down and he had your man propped up in the pillow and they were chatting away, the pair of them. And right beside the old gentleman and in a small bowl was a small, very small amount of nuts. And while Jack was speaking, he was eating the nuts out of the bowl. And they were talking about the Legion Oil, talking about fishing, things in general. And after a while, I said, Jack, I said, we're a bit along here. So I think he wants to go to sleep. We ought to leave. He said, yeah, I think we go, Charlie. He said, by the way, bye. He said, I'll be back again to see you again. He said, and by the way, I'm terribly sorry. He said, I think I'm after eating all your nuts. And your man said, don't be worrying, Jack. He said, it took me 2 weeks to suck the chocolate off them.
Charlie, it's been brilliant chatting to you. And 96 years of age, your memory still hasn't fitted you too badly anyway.
It's not bad, no. It's not bad. I'm not complaining.
Charlie, thanks very much for taking the call.
Not at all. Thank you.
Chat to you later.
Yeah, gentlemen. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, welcome back. So that is all we have time for on Team 33 this week. Thanks very much for listening. If you want to listen back to any of that, you can find us as part of the OTB Podcast Network on otbsports.com or on the new OTB app available now to download in the Google Play Store or Apple Store as well. As I mentioned, if you want to watch this back, you can find us on youtube.com/offthewall. We'll be back again at the same time and the same place. But until then, take away, Johan. OTB Podcast Network.